A Thought for Your Pennies is hosted by Shauna and Squeaky and explores ways to save money and tips to avoid scams, all while they share their own stories along the way. Get in touch by calling 970-425-3060 or emailing penniespod@gmail.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to A Thought for Your Pennies. I'm your host Shauna, here with my co-host Squeaky.
Hey, this is Squeaky, and I'm irresponsible with money, so you can better see what Shauna has to teach you.
That's right, Squeaky. It's kind of like a contrast and comparison with you and me on this show about saving money. But no, we're your friends here that are just trying to learn how to save money together. We are not professional finance advisors. Please don't make any life-altering decisions based on what we say without consulting a professional first. This is for entertainment purposes only, and Squeaky is entertaining. And I'm purposeful. So that's how you can kind of think about this show.
I'm going to take that as the highest form of compliment. Thank you.
As it was intended. And we're here today with our guest, Laura. Hey, Laura.
Hey, happy to be here.
Yeah, so glad to have you on the show as our first folks that we're interviewing about how to be financially savvy and just sharing with us some of the things that you've learned on how to be better with your pennies. So one of the things I just wanted to ask you is, you know, we usually start this show with a story about family or money. So do you have any awkward or funny stories that you want to share with us about savings or money?
Yeah, actually, I mean, I probably honestly have too many to count, but I don't want to have this entire interview be about me embarrassing myself.
What if you pick just one, perhaps the most embarrassing one?
Okay. I don't know if it's most embarrassing, but it definitely... I don't know. It definitely speaks to who I was at a moment in time. So a few years ago, I lived in the big city, in sort of nondescript large metropolitan area. And I was thinking, like every, I guess, saucy single gal, you want to kind of have your Carrie Bradshaw period of like life. You know, you want to go on a bunch of dates with fascinating, sophisticated men, and you want to spend most of your paycheck on cute clothes for those dates and for going out with friends.
Exciting.
So I was hitting those apps, as the youth say, and I was looking for my Mr. Big or Mr. Medium or, you know, Mr. Extra Small, whatever size, like, there's no prize, like, I'm the prize, you know? But nonetheless, I was swiping away, and when I'd go on dates, I had a rule that, you know, if the first date went well, I would try to leave a lasting impression by paying for it, which, like...
That's gotta go over. Interesting.
Yeah. I don't know if that was, like, the best way to create that lasting impression, but nonetheless, I did get texts back and more dates that I didn't have to pay for. But occasionally, nice. On those dates, when the check would come, I would kind of, you know, like, flip my hair and maybe say a funny little joke to the waiter or waitress to try and get them to not charge my card immediately. So I had like a quick moment to slyly check my bank account. Like, okay, I only have $60 left. He decided to get a margarita like a insane man, thinking I'm made of wealth, so I'm going to have to transfer like $80 over or something.
Wow. But, I mean, it sounds like it was an investment, really, because if you paid for the first date, then he would be like, or they would be like, oh, I want to go on a date with you again, and this time I'll pay three times for every one time that you paid.
So, I think the financial strategy here is first meal at Taco Bell, second meal at Fancy Steakhouse.
I wish. We did have a Taco Bell cantina in the city that did allow, like, did have Baja
Fancy
Blast margaritas, which are very romantic.
What?
Wow.
Beverage.
What?
Wow.
We got to get a link to that in the show notes. Where do we get this miracle of
Taco Bell?
I think, yeah.
Yeah, Google Taco Bell Cantina and find one in all good major metropolitans.
Oh no, I'm in Omaha. That rules that out. Never mind.
So, Laura, tell us what's your financial journey been like?
Probably the best, I guess, saying to encapsulate my financial journey would be building the bike as you're riding it or flying the plane as you're flying it. Ooh. I really did. I think in high school I didn't have any financial literacy classes. I think it became mandatory like the year after me because maybe they saw, oh, she's not on a good track. We've got to change this policy for all children after her. Ooh,
you were like, the example of the teacher being like, we need to fix this because people like her, we can't just let them loose in society like that anymore. We have a responsibility.
And then in college, there was one online financial literacy class that was built out kind of like the game of life. And so all I really remember was the user experience and not the, like, I don't know, actual lessons from it. So I have only recently in the last few years realized saving money is cool, not just because it's literally lifts a weight off of you. I think I did not fully understand the kind of physical impact of the stress from not being financially safe or secure had on me. And also, I don't think I knew how to save when there wasn't a definitive goal in mind. I was great at saving for trips to Europe, but I was not good at saving for like emergency expenses down the road. Because, you know, you're young, you're fun, you're, I would like to think, attractive. So you're like, nothing's bad is ever going to happen to me. Spend. Because if, you know, everything stops tomorrow, at least I went to Ireland, you know, tropical Ireland. My life as it is now and living in a small city and having a partner has made me realize, like, it'd be great to save for a house in the next few years. And I think also calculating how much money, now that I'm not paying off my credit card debt, how much money I'm saving a month. It's exciting to plan out, like, I'll be at my 6-month emergency savings in 3 months, or I'll be at enough saved for a vehicle in like the next 2, or moving expenses for when we move in together and things like that. I think right now, like, some of those milestones are like beneficial for planning financially, but also the potential milestones I will have now that I've gotten older and, you know, I'll probably get married and things like that. So
you mentioned, you know, that there was no financial literacy class when you were in high school, but there was one in college. What about your family or your parents? What were their kind of like financial messages?
My dad is just, to use like a New England, or a term I picked up in New England, my dad is wicked smart when it comes to saving money. I mean, he would talk to us about how he had jobs at the grocery store when he was 12 and he was buying like bonds, and how, you know, he's been saving for his future and his family, you know, since he had a concept of that. He came from a working class background in New Jersey, and I just think his frugalness and his ability to plan for the future is really inspiring. And it's paid off in leaps and bounds for me and my sisters and my mom.
Nice.
But also because he worked a lot, he wasn't always home or had the energy to be like, this is how you plan out your budget for the rest of your life. He occasionally would show us, but also we'd be like, ew, math, he. And women in STEM is important. Side note about that.
Right. Women in financial literacy is important. Yeah.
Math is good, okay? If you're 5 years old listening to this and you're a girl, math is good. But yeah, I didn't really get like a ton of formal lessons on financial stuff until I ran into problems and I asked for help. I think a lot of this was I didn't realize I should be asking for help earlier.
In the places of written software, there has been just a complete absence of women, right? Whether that be the insurance companies I've worked at or like when I worked at TD Ameritrade, right? I had expected it to be half women and maybe a tenth of that. So We need to do something about that. I don't know.
Yeah, Squeaky, your experience is not off. Like, according to Legal Momentum, women, even though they comprise half the workforce, 60% of them are the nation's lowest paid workers. So we're just not getting attracted or recruited or pipelined into the more payable professions. And this is already on top of the salary wage gap that exists between women and men. And of course, it gets worse if you are an older woman, if you are a woman of color. The gaps get worse and worse compared to white men.
Yeah, I keep trying to stack it against myself with the ugliest shirts and the ugliest hair possible, and I keep just getting high paying software contracts. I don't understand it.
Well, that's how you know it's a system, Squeaky, where men can continue to fail upward.
I'm going to fail as hard upward as I can. But I guess this is for both of you, because I'm curious. Because the system does work for me, right? I'm like, it's not always perfect. I do still struggle. But, like, clearly I struggle less than either of you two. How do you two work against that friction?
Well, there are definitely barriers to women becoming more financially independent and going into different fields or moving upwards in different fields. In my personal financial decisions, like, I made a lot of oopsies, and it's a lot of it was because I, like, didn't seek out awareness on my financial, like, literacy. However, I think those unique challenges to becoming more financially secure to women because of just the amount of marketing and social, I guess like being able to tap into like social life is dependent on spending money. Sort of back to my Carrie Bradshaw comment, you know, you're expected to always have a cute outfit, you know, go out to drinks with the gals or dinner or go shopping. There's not a lot of examples are, I guess, advertising or marketing, and especially in social media, you know, an influencer doesn't get rich or doesn't get notoriety for, like, chilling at home with their pals. They're always going on these luxurious trips and buying these cool clothes. And so there's not a lot of aspiration to do free things. So I think it takes a lot of creativity to seek those opportunities out and build those opportunities.
Yeah, I agree with Laura. It's not that the barriers are like you try to walk into an economics class on college and it's full of men and they're like, ew, stinky girl, get out of here. Or there's anything prohibiting women, right, from being financial masterminds. It's just like the soft societal pressure. Like,
oh, yeah.
There's like studies about how before puberty for women, for girls and boys, they're both equally interested in math. But then once you hit puberty and you start thinking about, oh, what do boys find attractive? They don't find women who are smart in math that attractive. And then the girls' participation in math just like plummets. And the same thing happens with girls in sports. It plummets because there's just societal expectations that are very powerful that put us into, I think, you know, being like, well, I don't want to learn about financial literacy because I don't need that. Or I need to, you know, and there's interesting, there's actually a book called I'm forgetting the name of it. It's like the Honor Code or something like that, that talks about how people who are in poverty stay in poverty, but it's because they're making the best economic decisions for themselves in ways that people from higher economic ladders don't understand. For example, they talked about how they went to this village in India and they got education for all the girls in the village because the idea is like, oh, once girls are educated, they'll be able to pull in higher salaries and help families. And so we should do that. So these girls get educated and yet they drop out and still go into their family arranged marriages because there's actually no high paying jobs for the things that they're getting educated on in that area. So if they actually want to succeed, they have to focus on marriage because getting a good marriage is more economically successful than having a degree with the availability of economic options in the area. And so if you look at people who come from like different classes or different genders, we typically are making the decisions that will secure economic success according to the societal pressures that we're getting, like, you know, don't study math, get a sugar daddy. So if you focus on your looks, that's the most important thing that you can do because even if you have that degree in math, nobody's going to hire you. You're still going to get discriminated against. But if you are one of the prettiest girls there, you have a better chance of climbing up a social class or climbing the economic ladder. But yeah, so I remember I was dating a guy and one of my friends was like, why are you dating him? He's a terrible person. Is he like a sugar daddy? I'm like, yeah, he's a sugar daddy at Costco. And she couldn't handle it. She was like, Costco, a Costco sugar daddy? What are you? He buy you a 10-pound bag of peanuts and you're like, ooh, my sugar daddy? And I was like, no, there was like expensive stuff at Costco, like, you know, the electric toothbrushes. I got one of those, you know, sugar daddy.
I mean, but that's like a fabulous souvenir, you know? I wish that 5 years after dating someone, I was still munching on the peanuts that they gave me instead of, you know, like talking to a therapist, you know, about what they really gave me, you know?
Totally a one for one side.
Right. Yeah, well, and Laura, I hear you on the credit card debt. There was a time in my life where I was like $25,000 deep in credit card debt, and I had to dig myself out. Okay. Yeah, so how did you get out?
So I had a revelation, maybe even divine intervention, in the summer of 2023. I was just kind of disillusioned with living in the aforementioned big city. I was disillusioned with the Mr. Bigs through Smalls, you know. And I realized that I was at a financial point where unless I made a pretty big life change, I would not be able to get out of this debt. Ooh. So the year before, I had actually in the year prior to this revelation, I'd taken out two personal loans to tackle the debt.
Okay.
And while the first one worked for like maybe 3 months, I just spent it right back up again. And the second one, I did the same exact thing. And so after those two loans essentially failed, I had visited some friends in a small city about 2 hours south, and I realized that I went to college in this city. I realized how much I missed that place, how much I missed the slower pace of life, and how it was a quarter less in living expenses than the city I was currently living in.
Nice.
And I did the numbers, and I realized with the amount I saved in rent in other living expenses, not having the temptation to go every weekend and pay for the lifts and pretend like I had a private driver, wear sunglasses at night, you know, the whole thing, looking like Mr. Worldwide Pitbull himself, Dolly. Anywho, I realized that what I needed to do was move the 2 hours south. And so I did. And I calculated out that, you know, not only would I be able to pay off my debt in a like about a year and some change, but also I'd start being able to save, I mean, through some very strict budgeting. I became acutely aware of how much money was just going out the door and how just checking my bank account like 2 times a week even had a massive effect. And so even through paying off my credit card debt and that personal loan debt, which was about $1,500 to $2,000 a month.
Wow.
I was able to keep a very strict personal budget for necessities and also make those payments and then be done with my credit card debt by like December of last year.
Nice.
That's great.
Thank you.
And you said you got this post-COVID, right?
Yeah. So I had gotten this, my first loan in 2022. And then my second was, I think, like spring of 23.
Yeah, I took out some loans pre-COVID that I still have because the interest rates are really low. So I'm fine just paying them off as they come. But, ooh, that's rough. That's rough.
It's interesting we're talking about this because there has been a bill introduced by Josh Harley, Republican Missouri, and Bernie Sanders, Independent Vermont, that would cap credit card interest rate at 10%, which would be amazing. That would be so amazing. And I don't know. I mean, can you imagine the backlash of people coming in like, well, I had a credit card where I had 38% pay off and I paid it off. And why can't kids these days pay that off?
Screw those crabs in a bucket. If you can't be happy for the next person doing better than yourself.
Yeah, right.
But also, not to be a Debbie Downer, womp womp, but what's the likelihood of that passing given probably like the credit card lobby?
Probably a lot less than 10%.
I just am impressed by the bipartisanship of this, where it's Bernie Sanders and a Republican are like, hey, let's do 10% cap on this credit card rate.
Yeah, for sure.
It's according to USA Today introduced. Yeah.
They're trustworthy.
Yes. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. Laura, do you have anything, bits of wisdom or anything to share with our listeners who are like you, just trying to save money?
Yeah, the only thing I would share is just, you know, while you should definitely take in all the different financial advice you can from people you admire and, you know, people you trust in terms of making financial decisions, I think you should also, you know, take a step back before you try too hard to apply too many of those to you. It took me years to figure out what worked. I did spreadsheets, apps, you know, going cash only for like unnecessary purchases and stuff like that. And so it's taken a lot of trial and error. And so definitely know what works, you know, be hesitant to subscribe to just one theory, try and experiment with them all. And also forgive yourself. I think shame can really stop you from being honest about your financial situation, not just with others, but with yourself. So don't be an internal cop in telling yourself, like, you can't do that, or you can't do this, because, you know, sometimes you need a little treat, you know? And if you're in that hole, baby, what's a pebble, you know?
That's great advice.
No, make it like a Reese's cup. Don't make it a Dolce & Gabbana bag.
Brilliant advice. Thank you.
Well, thanks again for coming on the show. I think, you know, what your story shows is like resilience to keep on trying again. There is no like magic bullet to being financially fit, and you just have to keep on trying. And I think that's how you get there. So thanks so much for sharing your journey with us, Laura. It was great to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much. It was great to be on.
And if any of you out there want to share your financial tips or how you got yourself out of credit card debt, you can email us at athoughtforyourpenniespod@gmail.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back to A Thought for Your Pennies, the show where we learn how to save together because, honestly, we could all change. I'm Shauna, and this is Squeaky.
Hey, this is Squeaky. But, Shauna, isn't change inedible?
And I think you mean change is inevitable, Squeaky. That's what you mean. Oh, God, in heaven, Squeaky, what is...
No, it's inedible.
Are those coins?
I'm supposed to be a penny thinker, right?
Well, yeah. Instead of a penny eater, penny chewer, whatever it is.
I think I need to work on the thinker part, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. You could do some more thinking. Okay. Your commitment to the bit, Squeaky. Did you just put one back in your mouth? Okay.
No.
Anyway, so today segment is over. Talking about the scam portion, we just had our interview with Laura about her financial journey and what it took for her to get out of credit card debt, and we're going to keep on talking about credit cards and how credit card processing fees are a scam for merchants, which is interesting, especially if you're a small business owner, but to think about from our point of view as consumers with this. But we're going to talk about the cost to business as it relates to the acceptance of electronic payments, meaning, you know, credit and debit and EFT or ACH transactions. So strap yourself in. Do not eat the change. Be the change when it comes to saving money.
Oh.
Okay. There we go. Yeah. They're all out now. Great. Great.
You can't prove they're not.
Okay. Well, have you ever seen a sticker or a sign on a credit card terminal, you know, at a business or convenience store that's like, okay, all credit card charges must be at least this much?
Yeah, yeah.
And is that always, I mean, to me, I'm just like, well, that's scammy. I'm like, they're just a slushy for like $1.89 or something, and it's like minimum charge is $5.
So I don't have the right perspective you want. I have multiple times been the merchant. And I have written software for credit card payment processing.
Okay. So you've never been being like, wow, I just want a Slurpee and I don't want to find other things to get to the $5 minimum charge.
I have been exactly in that position, but
okay.
At the time, having written credit card payment processing software and knowing why this existed, I always had cash on me. So,
okay.
So I don't know. I don't know. But I get where it's coming from, and I get why it seems skeezy.
Yeah, and I bank at a place where they pay for my ATM fees so that I can avoid paying the credit card processing fees and pay cash for stuff. But yeah, it does seem like a scam, but from your point of view, is kind of what we're getting into, that any business that accepts payments by credit cards have to pay a fee, often to multiple recipients for that transaction. So it always costs a business owner more to accept your card than if you paid them in cash and you paid the ATM fee.
So that's real close to true, and it's true enough, but there is a real cost to handling cash. Because,
oh, there is. Okay.
Well, because you have to pay someone to secure it. Some amount of cash just goes missing because hands get sticky. There have to be
people start eating the change out of the change drawer instead of just depositing it.
These were my own pennies. I didn't eat someone else's pennies.
Okay, that's great. Well, yeah, I agree with you. There is cash handling services. Like, you need to, as a business merchant, especially like a gas station, you know, you see those signs like cashier never has more than $100 in change or something like that. And that's because they put it in a permanent lockbox, yeah, which I'm sure is expensive, that a security company has to come and pick up for a deposit to try to keep the robberies down. Things like that. Yeah. So there are cash handling fees.
And if you're a big company, think like McDonald's, right? Mm. They have to pay a worker a wage to bring cash around and to do things. Throughout the day, periodically, McDonald's will send someone to the nearest bank. And often, they each franchise just has a deal with the local bank. And they will just go there and just convert money because they will need change for different things. And there's an hourly fee associated with that you just don't have with credit cards.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we're going to talk some of the industry terminology, but try to focus primarily on the impact and ways that we as consumers can support businesses, i.e. not taking the change we just ate and rolling it up and giving it to them to process.
Well, hang on.
That is not a good idea.
We have a merch store, right? Because I would like to, I think we can offer these pennies to our audience.
I mean, Squeaky, that sounds more like an OnlyFans thing that you could hustle on the side. We do not have pre-chewed pennies merch.
Look how shiny this is. Now, yes. Granted, most of that's my saliva, but uh-huh. I think we can sell these for $10 a pop.
Well, I got to keep it real. So let's talk about real ways that consumers can support businesses and neighbors that are minimally impactful to them and beneficial to us. So awesome. let's go through real fast through the terminology and some concepts, right? So networks and relationships, right? So card networks follow the major card types. Open networks, Visa and MasterCard, allow other institutions to offer cards on their network, like your Visa card or MasterCard debit card issued through Chase or some other banking institution. Closed networks, like Discover or American Express, are both the issuer and the network.
Okay. I haven't heard it divided that way, but that makes a lot of sense to think about it that way. Yeah. Because like First National issued me a Visa card. That makes sense. Yeah.
Now, an issuer is the bank that provides the account or card, like Bank of America, Southwest Airlines, Mileage Reward Card. You mentioned First National Bank of Omaha. These are all the card issuers, which is the bank, right?
Yeah.
And then the merchant processor is the platform or company that allows businesses to be able to accept, process, and settle electronic payments from customers.
So this is the people who move the money around behind the scenes or make promises they're moving the money around behind the scenes so that way you can spend money instantly even if you don't have it. So like Visa's promising to move a bunch of money around behind the scenes so your card works. And when at the end of the day all the accounts need to be reconciled, Visa will make sure people get paid the amount they're supposed to be paid. Or do I have that mixed up?
I don't know, because I thought the merchant processor are companies like First Data. Like, they're the people who own the payment
like, gateways. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. I skipped a step.
Yeah. Like, no, you're like right. First you're right. Data or Stripe or, you know, when you're at some place, like, that's the merchant processor. So merchant account fees overview, and this is an article from SwipeSum. So the way these merchant processors or merchant account fees, there's different pricing models, like a flat rate pricing model. They'll have a flat per transaction fee, a percentage of the transaction amount, or a combo. Fixed percentages are typically between 1.75 and 3% include per transaction fees. So that's one model.
To break that out into something more like English, every time you swipe your card at a place, the vendor you're buying from. So if you go buy a burger, right? And let's say the whole meal's $10, right? There's going to be some percentage fee, like let's say 2% plus maybe 50 cents to process that transaction that burger joint is paying to First Data or whatever other payment processor, who then in turn pays the actual credit network, you know, Visa, you know, whomever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one model, is a per transaction fee and plus a percentage of the transaction.
That's really common. Yeah. What are the other ways?
There's interchange pricing models, also known as cost plus, that these can be more transparent and cost effective. So what this does is it allows the merchant to see exact breakdowns of where each fee is going, which can help them identify gaps and decrease processing costs. And we'll discuss this more in the how fees are determined in this segment a little later.
Yeah, that might be new. I guess I've been out of it for a while. Okay.
Time to get back in that merchant processing programming field, Squeaky.
It's so boring.
And then the third fee overview is tiered pricing. And so this is even more complicated cost structures. It's the least transparent of the pricing models that I've talked about so far. Tiered pricing depends on the type of card being used. So whether it's credit or it's debit or it's a prepaid card, it also includes other costs that might not even show up on merchant statements. And it can also depend on how the card was accepted. So was it present, or did the cashier type in the numbers? Was it tapped or swiped or inserted?
let me make this more concrete. Imagine you're calling like an old millennial. You're calling to order a pizza, right?
Like an old millennial ordering a pizza.
Yep.
Those were the days.
Yep. You and me, the old millennials ordering pizza on the phone.
On the phone.
We tell the vendor.
We didn't need no Uber Eats. You just called them. And they brought you your food.
But if you call, there's a higher chance of fraud because the card isn't present. So that pizza place has to agree with the payment processor and with Visa and Amex and Discover that they have to agree that they're disclosing what percentage of their transactions don't have the card present. So they pay a slightly higher transaction fee. You know, it might be, you know, an extra 0.5% or an extra 30 cents per transaction or something, compared to a place that only accepts it in person. So if you go to Subway, you're never ordering, you know, online or over the phone.
Okay. So another old millennial moment. You ready for this, Squeaky?
Uh-oh.
Do you remember the days when you had a physical card and the numbers on that physical card were raised? They are now flat. Do you remember those days?
I still have some cards that are raised.
Because they were raised because they used to prove that you had a physical copy of the card.
Ka-chunk.
Take a carbon, what is it, a carbon copy?
The imprint paper, yeah.
The paper, and they would come out with this huge machine.
I thought you hit your microphone to demonstrate the noise the machine made, because it went ka-chunk.
It went ka-chunk, right? But you would be at a restaurant and they would bring like this thing that was like huge and heavy and put your credit card in it and then run your credit card over the run a heavy thing over the top of your credit card to make an imprint into this paper.
Yeah, it was like one big machine.
Yeah.
No batteries or anything, like just a purely mechanical device. It was
right.
About as big as a dinner plate. You put a credit card in it, and you slide it along, and it has this spring, so it's always at one end or the other, and it goes ka-chunk, and you pull it back, ka-chunk, and it forced the raised numbers on the card into the paper, and they have this now permanent record of your card.
So let me tell you, kids, before they had swiping, before they had chips, before they had tapping, they had the ka-chunk thing.
Now, you're still putting off old lady vibe, Shauna.
Okay.
What they have now is... it's just saved in your browser.
I feel like, you know, a wizard when I'm at the store and I tap and I'm paid. I'm like, yes, I am accepted everywhere. You know, it's like. Anyway, kids, they don't know how wizardly they are. Or maybe they do. Maybe they do. But they'll never hear the magic of ka-chunk with their credit cards anymore.
I mean, we'll just
debit cards.
Make it a ringtone if we want to get really old school.
I feel like. It was one of those vibrations you could feel in your chest. Anyway,
that's
so Okay. It's like, is there an earthquake coming on? No, they're just swiping the machine. Got it. Okay. So those are the three pricing models we talked about. Flat pricing, which is like per transaction fee, and then a percentage. Interchange pricing models, which are cost plus. Tiered pricing, which is the most complicated. And if you're a small business owner, you're really not going to get into this. So those are all the different models, but there's also a bunch of different kinds of fees that you'll be paying as a business owner accepting credit and debit cards. Honestly, the more I get into this article, the more I'm like, yep, I'm going to be one of those places that has an ATM machine and be like, go over there and give me cash because I'm not dealing with all this. So now we're going to get into the types of fees. Are you ready?
For fees? No, never.
Yeah, all right, that's fair, but plowing ahead.
Let's do it.
Let's do it for the small business owners out there. So you got interchange fees, which are set by the credit card networks to be paid to the issuer, right? So this is
because everybody in this process has to make their money.
Right. Everybody gets a cut.
Fees make that happen. Ugh.
Right. Assessment fees. So this is paid to the card networks themselves for maintenance and operation of the networks that process transactions. Because I guess the network is something different than whatever is connected to your phone internet line. Although you do need internet in order to process credit cards.
All right. Today you need internet. Back in the day, machines that were more advanced than the Kachonker used to dial in and use the phone system. But when they say the network, they mean the agreement network. The group of businesses that have agreed to participate and make this happen. Like when you're doing health insurance, your doctor's in or out of network. It's not technical networks, it's a business network.
And then there's monthly minimums. So this is paid to the merchant processing servicer, usually used with smaller businesses that may not otherwise hit minimum costs due to the low volume of their transactions.
Yeah.
There is an authorization fee that's charged every time a card is swiped, even if the transaction declines, because information is sent back and forth between the acquiring bank and the issuing bank.
It's my understanding those are becoming less and less common because, you know, the internet exists. But it used to be that every single time you swiped a card, it had to make a phone call.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Like AOL dial-up.
Something like that. It was quieter. But yeah, in principle, the same.
Okay. We're not done with fees. Merchant service providers use transaction fees to describe the per transaction fee they collect. So depending on the pricing plan that small business you're buying from is using, it may also include the percentage applied or authorization fee, which is, I think, what you were talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, there are assessment fees also. They are charged by the card member associations for various expenses, including fraud prevention and network operations. Merchant service providers often pass these along to their customers. And I will say, I am very glad for fraud prevention because there has been a couple of times where I've caught things on my card and I've been like, I was never there. I don't know what this is, and was able to instantly report it. Or I bought something online and the company I was buying from like charged me for the wrong thing, or it was broken or didn't ever arrive. And I am glad that I don't have to like be like Liam Neeson and I will find you for sending me the wrong thing, that I could contact my credit card company and be like, hey, this is wrong.
Absolutely. So, I found a whole bunch of credit card fraud on my transactions when I went out to visit you, Shauna. Yeah, there were a ton of transactions put in this place called D Never. I have no clue what that was about. I marked all of those fraud.
D Never?
Is that not how you say it?
Where I live.
Oh.
Denver.
How do you?
Denver.
I.
D-E-N-V-E-R. Not D-N-E-V-E-R.
I might be in real trouble.
All right. Well, much sorrow to Squeaky's bank. But for me, I had legit fraud stuff going on. So very glad that those assessment fees are there because I use them. I make sure that I do not get scammed. And so here's the fees on rates per transaction. For American Express, it's typically a 0.15% fee per transaction. For Discover, it's a 0.13%. MasterCard, also 0.13%. And Visa, 0.14%.
So those do fluctuate. Visa tends to have the lowest because they're the biggest. And then Discover and the other ones that are less common often try to provide some kind of value to the different businesses they want to support, like better fraud prevention or some other kinds of promises.
I mean, I did look into the American Express card, like their top tier. You have to pay $750 a year card to be because the perk they give you as the card holder. I don't think the merchants get anything for accepting this card, but the card holder, you get access to airport lounges, but then the airport lounges are often overcrowded and you end up in a wait line with them because everybody wants an airport lounge. So now I'm just like, you know what? I can just sweat it out with the plebs. I'm not going to wait in line with the exclusive credit card people.
Yeah, I don't understand those things. I have access to airport lounges on a couple of my cards. I don't even think I know where the lounge is in my local airport.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll look for a line.
I mean, one time I did pay for a lounge because I was like buying a ticket and it was like, do you want to access to our lounge for $75? And it was a 9-hour layover. And I was like, yeah, worth it, because I looked in the benefits and explicitly said, you can sleep here in this lounge. They have sleep rooms. And I was like, yeah, that's what I'm, because it was like one of those red eye day night things. So I was like, all right, yeah, I will go ahead and pay $75. And the lounge was super nice.
That's
the sleep area was not sketchy, and the food in there was free and the drinks were free. So well worth the $75. So I think rather than paying $750 a year, I'll just pay that, you know, per time I need to actually use a lounge. Well, so that's all the fees that I went through. There won't be a test about this later, but very informative section. But here's how fees are determined. There's a number of variables that influence the cost and quality of the credit and debit card transactions. With higher transaction amounts and processing volume, the fees should decrease. So these include the types of card used, the payment processors, acquisition banks, the client's banks, whether it's a digital in-person transaction, and the card company that issued the card to its customers, all discount rates applied by the payment processing company, and whether it applies to the card issued by them.
All right, the English parts of that that matter for our listeners probably is, if the businesses you go to do more business with cards, usually using cards gets cheaper for them.
Okay, there's more. There's also flat merchant account fees, meaning if you don't process the minimum number of transactions you agreed to, or the minimum in revenue the processor requires, or both, then you pay the extra fee.
Yeah.
So, and also, let's not forget the situational merchant account fees, okay? Don't want to leave them out in all of the fees.
I remember working for a small pawn shop. This was a weird thing. This wasn't software. They were bringing in pallets of busted laptops, and I was soldering and fixing them for them. And then at some point, they brought me on full time for a couple months, and I was helping them sort this out. And they had an agreement where they promised they'd have at least 50 transactions per month. Mm. And they were paying for 50 transactions per month, even if they only got like 45. So they tried
to avoid that extra fee. Yeah.
Yeah, well, because it's just the difference. They will pay for a minimum of 50 each month. Because, it just wasn't worth the processor's time otherwise.
Yeah. So I imagine things like pawn shops and other different specialty stores do have some sort of situational merchant account fees, because these are for things like address verification, calling in a transaction over the phone versus electronic payment, voice authorization fees, and more. So if this is starting to feel like your last interaction with a large name ticket vendor, you're not wrong.
Ugh.
Well, so that is a lot, but that is how merchants are paying a lot. And so when they say minimum purchase required, they're not trying to scam you. They are the ones getting scammed.
No, so we're just building empathy here. There's not a lot we can do that's actionable, is there? I mean, it's pay cash if you can to help your local businesses, but the big guys don't care.
I gotta say, you know, if I'm going out and the place is cash only, then I know it's good. Then I'm like, okay, they are focused on whatever it is they're making. They are not focused on trying to pay a bunch of fees. So supporting these small businesses, these mom and pop places that are like, there's the ATM machine over there. Then I'm like, all right, the food here, whatever they're selling here is about to be real good because they're cash only. So this has been our episode on merchant processing fees. We tried to make it as interesting and as funny as possible, but if there is something funnier that we missed, please let us know. We'd love to hear your take, your hot take on merchant processors. So you can email us at thoughtforyourpenniespod@gmail.com Or you can call us at 970-425-3060 and leave a short message and we'll share it on air so that we can all learn how to save money together and change for the better.
And don't forget to email Shauna and ask if you can get one of my mouth pennies for $10.
I won't do it.
Thank you.